Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former professional runner. In today's episode, I'll be answering questions that have been submitted to me by listeners. And if you would like to submit a question for a future Q&A episode, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. Another week down. I personally am over-caffeinated as per usual on Fridays. That's just the way it is for me, you know? It's one of those days. I hope everyone is having a good spring so far out here in LA. This is my first spring, and it's beautiful. Everything is blooming. All of our walks smell so good. There's like jasmine trees everywhere. Really loving the spring out here. But I know, being from Colorado, that sometimes states are still getting snow. So if that's you, I hope you're thawing out a little bit. And we're so close to having some warmer weather, getting ready for beautiful training season. So hope everyone's having a good week. Today's episode is a Q&A. And as per usual, I just want to start out with my random thoughts. And I was laughing because yesterday, so my younger brother, he is a firefighter, and he called me on speakerphone at their firehouse dinner because he was on shift. And he's like, "I need you to settle a debate." And I was like, "Okay, I feel like this is a trap." And he asked me, they were talking about quinoa and couscous. And so he's like, "Which one is better, quinoa or couscous?" So I would say, first of all, that's just a glimpse into my life as a dietitian. If people know what I do for a living, I will get calls like that or texts or questions all the time, which is always just entertaining and fun. And I'm always happy to answer questions. So that's always fun. And the questions that people have and come up with always surprise me. And this one was a question that just kind of made me laugh, because I get these questions a lot where it's like, which one is better? Which one should I choose? Which one would you choose? And I think this is, for me, where it can be frustrating as a dietitian, not that people are asking me these questions, but that we've created a society where we feel the need to constantly label foods as like better or worse or good or bad. And this is a good example of diet culture in action, where we feel like there is a better option, like there's one that's going to be better than the other. And my question is always, better for what? Better for who? Better for an athlete? Better for somebody with celiac disease? Better for dinner? Better for breakfast? Better for nutrients? And it's not as simple as one is always better than the other. And I think that's an important distinction to make, especially for things that we see on social media, where there's always this blanket statement of like, whole wheat is always better than white flour. And that's not always true. So when we're thinking about foods like quinoa and couscous, they're different, right? I wouldn't say one is better than the other. They're very different. Quinoa is an ancient grain. It has more fiber. It is gluten-free, whereas couscous is a wheat product, so it does have gluten. When we're breaking down nutrients, you know, they are not that different, because couscous is typically made with enriched wheat flour. You're going to get a good nutrition profile. There's going to be protein in there. Quinoa also has protein. So if I'm working with an athlete who's choosing between couscous and quinoa, there are a few things I'm going to consider to decide when which one should be chosen over the other. And that's not going to be the case all the time. So since quinoa has more fiber and it's harder to digest, that's not something I would recommend for pre-run. I would say if you're having lunch, couscous would be preferable over quinoa for pre-run. But maybe we're having dinner and this person is gluten-free, quinoa would be my suggestion because they can't have couscous because it has gluten in it. And I think when we try to classify foods as good or bad or better or worse, we're sort of restricting ourselves. We're eliminating altogether one or the other. So if I said quinoa was better, then that person probably would never eat couscous. And couscous can be a great food sometimes and a great way to make things more interesting and a great alternative to pasta if you're bored of pasta dishes. So I just challenge you guys in your daily life, when you find yourselves hearing those kinds of things, whether that's on social media or podcasts or the radio or whatever, you're hearing somebody say, this is better than this. Try to think of situations where that's not true, because there will be some. And I think the more we can work to dismantle some of these thoughts and myths around food, the better our relationships with food become and the less stress we experience when we have to make a food choice. And especially if you were, let's say, at a restaurant that didn't have quinoa, they only had couscous. If you had eliminated couscous altogether, that might be a stressful situation. And I mean, I don't know any restaurants that only serve couscous, but you know what I'm saying. It's something where you do restrict yourself, and it can happen slowly over time. And before you know it, you're like, oh, I can't go to this restaurant because they don't serve X, Y, and Z, or they only serve X, Y, and Z, and I don't eat that. And it does become difficult. And again, just thinking about conversations with people around you, if someone has struggled with their relationship with food or with fueling, and you're constantly talking about how you can't eat this or this is better than that, that's not necessarily helpful for that person to hear. And, you know, same goes for if you're somebody who struggles with your relationship with food, you know how it feels when somebody around you says, oh, I don't eat that. That's really triggering. That's really stressful. And so I just laughed because, of course, it was just like a harmless, fun question that he called to ask me on speaker. But they were kind of surprised by my answer because, you know, I think as a dietitian, people assume I'm going to say one is healthier, one is better. But that's not what dietitians would say. That's more of what I had talked about last time. Somebody who's less qualified in nutrition, who doesn't understand the nuances, who hasn't studied, you know, everything about nutrition and nutritional sciences, they might be more likely to say, oh, quinoa is always better. And that's not always true. So anyway, just my little thought for this Friday. There is never a situation in which one food is always better than another. And I encourage you guys to challenge those views or those thoughts in your own life. The last thing I wanted to mention before I start answering questions, just a quick fueling forward announcement. I am going to be starting a newsletter, which I am super excited about. This is another sort of passion project like this podcast that is scary and challenging for me, but I think it's going to be really helpful to a lot of people. So I am starting two newsletters. One is just a free monthly newsletter that you'll get in the first of each month. It's just going to give you a recipe highlight. So something that I've tried over the last month that I really enjoyed. I'm going to include some quick fueling tips and tricks. I will include rapid fire thoughts. So things about, you know, what I'm seeing in social media or that I'm hearing about in the running community that are related to nutrition. And then any fueling forward announcements will be in there as well. And then the second newsletter that I'm starting, it's a weekly newsletter. It's going to be called the Sunday Brunch Club. It's going to come out every Sunday morning. And it's going to include a lot of resources to help you guys have a successful week of fueling. Something I get asked a lot is, can you write me a fueling plan or do you have a fueling plan? And this newsletter is going to be my personal fueling plan. So I'm just going to share with you guys what my plan is for the week. And that's how I approach planning out my meals and snacks for the week. Is I take some time on the weekend, I gather all my recipes, I pick a few things I want for each meal and for snacks, I make my grocery list, and I put all that together. So those are things I'm going to be putting in this newsletter for you guys. So every single week, you can see ideas for breakfast, lunch, dinners, snacks, and then recipes as well. So if you're someone who has limited time to do that planning, or let's say you're a college athlete, you're new to planning and cooking on your own, I'm hoping this will be really helpful. I know it's something I really would have benefited from back in the day, and also when I was at my busiest, this would have been awesome. So that's going to be one part of that weekly newsletter. Another part will be an accountability challenge. So every week I'm going to include a very specific challenge for readers to work on creating more sustainable, healthy fueling habits. So things like, you know, drinking more water, fueling before runs. I just thought it'd be fun to have some guidance on how to do that. And then also the accountability of knowing there's a community of other people working towards the same goal. I think that's really motivating for me personally. Another section will be called Science Corner, so I'll just kind of be breaking down nutrition myths that I'm seeing, you know, social media or hearing about in other places. And then my last section is going to be called Food for Thought, which is where I'll just include any and all relevant thoughts around nutrition and running. I'll talk about my own training, you know, anything else I'm noticing in the world that's relevant, inspiring, or helpful for you guys. And so I'm really excited about these newsletters, and if you're interested in checking them out, please head over to my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the newsletter tab. You can subscribe to the free monthly newsletter on there, and you can also subscribe to the paid weekly newsletter. It's only $5 a month, which is only the cost of one coffee out per month, and you can also get a free 2-week trial if you want to test it out and see if it's for you before you actually commit to paying for that. So I'm super excited about those. Please check them out if you're interested. And yeah, definitely something that I hope will be really helpful for you all. All right. So diving into the questions, I also want to say thank you to everyone who's been submitting questions. It's always so fun for me to read them, and I wish I could get through more each week. So I'm still chipping away at the list. Please continue sending in your questions, because I'm really enjoying reading them and answering them. And it's always fun to see some overlapping questions, because like I've said before, if you have that question, chances are somebody else has it too. So there's no such thing as a simple or a dumb question, because everyone else is wondering the same thing. And so I wanted to start with this question today, because I get a lot of questions about generally like aging populations. What should we be doing? So this question says, how should people adjust their nutritional needs as they get older? Aside from cutting out quote unquote junk food, I'm curious as to what our body needs more of compared to when we were younger. With this question, the way that I would answer any question in general is thinking about what are the goals behind this question. So for a population that's aging, the goal would be to combat some of the potential declines that come with the aging process. So for example, bone density loss is something that happens to all of us as we age. And the older we get, the more bone density loss we experience. And so that's something where I would say, from a nutritional standpoint, focusing on bone health, reducing the rate of cognitive decline. So we see more things like dementia pop up as we get older. So supporting brain health is certainly something. Something else to consider is that men and women age differently. So women go through menopause in their 40s or 50s. And this is an extreme change for our bodies, because our hormone levels are really shifting. So we essentially lose all these hormones, and our bodies change as a result of that in a way that men don't experience. And for men, their bodies may not change really until their 50s, even into their 70s. It's a very different process for men versus women. So I think that's important to consider as well. If you're seeing something about this is good for an aging population, think about your biological gender, what makes the most sense based on research for you. And it may not be the same thing. That goes for things like intermittent fasting. You know, for men, the results are very different than for women. And so there's never going to be something that should be done in all populations. And as I've sort of talked about, if you heard Katie Rainsberger's episode, we talked a lot about how there's not much research done on women in general. So aging women, especially going through menopause, these are things we don't have a lot of research on. So some of the things you might see online may not apply to you. So I just wanted to point that out generally. But typically with adults in aging populations, so this would be, you know, like for women postmenopausal, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s kind of age groups, we do want to focus on increasing proteins. We experience a lot more muscle loss as we age. And the way to combat that is by increasing your protein intake. And protein is going to be the building block for all muscle tissue. Same thing even for bone. Protein helps build up bone. So whereas, you know, a younger population, I might recommend trying to get 20 to 30 grams of protein post-training. For postmenopausal women, for example, the recommendation is 30 to 40 grams of protein post-training. working. So it increases quite a bit. And I would say general day to day, just trying to prioritize protein as you age is really going to help combat some of that muscle loss that happens later in life. Another thing that can happen is just overall digestion and ability to eliminate things goes down. We see more sluggish systems, we might see more buildup of things, and having, you know, regular bowel movements, being able to eliminate things from your body is very important. So getting extra fiber as you're getting older can really help with some of those symptoms as well, maintain your gut health, and, you know, just kind of support overall nutrition goals. Omega-3s are something else that I recommend older populations focus on. So these are anti-inflammatory, so they're beneficial for anyone who's an athlete, but they also really support cognitive and cardiovascular health. So the older you get, like I said earlier, there's an increased chance of having something like dementia or heart disease happening, and that's just because that's how our bodies age. So omega-3s can help mitigate some of the things that are happening that lead to dementia or cardiovascular disease. So getting more things like walnuts, fatty fish like salmon and tuna, olive oil, other nuts and seeds, those are some things that if you can incorporate more of, that can definitely help mitigate some of those aging-related symptoms. This last thing I'll say, it's not really nutrition related, but generally speaking, as you get older, focusing more on strength training and resistance training is so, so good for you. This really helps prevent a lot of that muscle loss, like I said, that we see with aging populations. It's also a great way to support your bone health. Anytime you're lifting, the muscle is pulling on the bone, which is actually how we stimulate bone to grow, to produce more more bone, essentially. So incorporating more strength training, heavier lifting as you get older really, really helps with some of those things. And it also helps you maintain balance and strength so you can continue to do things like run or play with your kids or your grandkids as you get older. So again, I think just thinking backwards from what are my goals as someone who's going to be aging? And, you know, like for me personally, I want to make sure I'm able to continue to run, and I want to make sure I'm able to, you know, jump up off the couch or, you know, chase future grandkids or whatever it may be. So starting when you're younger, focusing on those things that will potentially prevent you from doing that in the future. So preventing that muscle loss, preventing bone density loss, focusing on your cognitive and cardiovascular health. Those are things that will help with the aging process. And then again, from an athlete standpoint, maintaining your muscle strength will help you continue to maintain performance. Fueling around your runs, you know, still really important. But those are just some additional considerations for somebody who is, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s kind of aging, quote unquote, aging population. Okay, this next question says, hi, I've heard that regular blood work and labs can be helpful for supporting your nutrition and sports performance goals. I recently learned that markers like ferritin are long stores, and so improvements via diet or supplementation of iron, if appropriate, can take a few months to appear in labs. Does the same apply for other common biomarkers that endurance athletes look at? Thinking of thyroid, vitamin D, creatinine, hemoglobin, etc. Any recommendations for learning more about ranges that are appropriate for athletes if different than standard ranges? This is a fantastic question and one that I really wish more endurance athletes knew about, because I see this a lot in my practice where I'll have an athlete come to me who's experiencing a lot of symptoms of low iron, and they'll say, oh, I got my blood work done, but my doctor told me everything looked fine. So with blood work in general, a couple things to consider. The ranges that you see on those sheets with your results that you often are interpreting your results through, they are huge. So for ferritin, for example, you'll see a normal range be from like 10 to 150, which is huge. And for athletes, if I see a ferritin below 30, I'm flagging that. But I've had athletes come to me whose ferritin has been 12, and they say, oh, my doctor said everything's fine, it's within the normal range. So that is definitely something that I encourage you to challenge a little bit. If you have symptoms and your labs look quote unquote normal, trying to work with a practitioner who is well versed in those sports performance specific ranges can be really helpful. When it comes to seeing things change, like when to get labs retested and things like that, most of the cells in our body have a half-life of about 8 to 12 weeks, 2 to 3 months. So half-life meaning that's about how long it takes for the majority of our cells to change into these new cells. And so if we're trying to restore iron levels or we're trying to improve nutritional status, it takes about 8 to 12 weeks to see real changes in your labs. And so that's why I recommend for athletes to get blood work done before training or racing starts. So let's say you're a high school or college runner and you're going to be competing in some big track races in, you know, April. I know at this point we're almost in April, but what I recommend to those athletes is getting blood work done in January or February so you have enough time to change those labs before racing starts. So if you're doing, like, let's say a fall marathon, you would probably want to get your labs checked in June or July so you have plenty of time to correct those and check at least one more time before the race. If you're retesting really close to a race, generally I don't recommend that just because you can kind of get in your head if you see labs aren't changing. So at the very minimum, you know, getting some lab work done 8 weeks out, doing everything you can to address it with nutrition or supplementation if necessary. And then you can always retest after your race just to see what that looks like for future direction. But just keeping in mind too, timing of your race. I would say when we're thinking about something like ferritin being a long-term storage marker, kind of what you were asking in your question, the way that I heard it described in college is that ferritin is sort of like your money in your wallet, and hemoglobin is like your money in the bank. So ferritin is a storage form of iron, but it's also the first thing to drop in early stage iron deficiency. And there's different phases of iron deficiency, different stages. Stage one is where your ferritin is dropping, but your hemoglobin looks okay, and you may or may not have symptoms in that phase. Phase two, usually your ferritin's even lower. Now we're digging into the bank. We're spending all that money in our wallet. Now we're having to pull money out of the bank. So we see hemoglobin start to drop. And then stage three, which is usually full-on anemia, everything is super, super low. So that's another benefit to checking your labs frequently, especially if you have a history of low iron. You can catch iron dropping before it starts to impact your performance. There's other labs that you do want to look at when you're looking at iron. Ferritin by itself also does not tell the whole story. So ferritin is very prone to changes based on inflammation. So if you are really inflamed, or let's say you had just run, your ferritin might look too high. If you're dehydrated, labs can look higher than they should be or than they actually are because your blood volume is lower, so everything is more concentrated. If you get blood work done after you run, that lowers your blood volume and can affect those labs. So the other thing when you're getting lab work done is you want to make sure the conditions under which you're getting them done are the same. My recommendation is to try to go first thing in the morning, ideally fasted for most labs, not all labs. Like iron, you don't have to be fasted for. Before you run for sure, regardless, before any type of training, and then ideally in a hydrated state, so you can drink, you know, 8 to 16 ounces of water before you go get blood work done. But I wouldn't be chugging a ton of water because that can do the opposite. That can dilute everything in your blood and make it look too low. The other thing is that if you are taking any supplements, so like iron, for example, and you're wanting to retest your iron, you need to stop taking those about 24 to 48 hours before your blood draw, or those will look elevated. So like for ferritin or total iron saturation, if you take your supplement the day before you get your blood drawn, those usually look too high. Those are things I think doctors don't tell athletes to do, which I wish they would, because they really impact how your labs can be interpreted. So first and foremost, making sure that you're getting your labs drawn under the right conditions. Second, again, making sure you're getting them done at least 8 weeks before you have a competition coming up. And that's even if you don't have symptoms. It's always good to have a baseline just when you're feeling good, just so you can see if you don't feel good anymore, how things have changed. And that's important too if you're going to work with someone like a dietitian who can help you determine if you're fueling adequately. We'll see labs like iron decrease with underfueling, especially, and not getting enough carbs. So then, like I was saying with ferritin, you know, that's definitely a marker of iron that I encourage athletes to look at. That's usually one doctors don't order. So parents, coaches, athletes, I highly recommend asking for ferritin. Usually they will include a CBC panel, which is looking at your red blood cell health. That's going to include things like hemoglobin and hematocrit. But then I also recommend asking for total iron and TIBC, or total iron binding capacity. That can tell us more about how iron is actually moving into your cells. Sometimes I'll have athletes whose hemoglobin and ferritin look good, but their iron saturation is super low and they have symptoms of low iron. And that's usually because we don't have the right nutrients to move iron from our blood into our cells. So it can create a cellular condition of low iron, even though you actually have enough iron in your blood. Other biomarkers that I encourage athletes to get checked regularly, so thyroid function, specifically looking at TSH levels, thyroid stimulating hormone, those can tell us about things like overtraining, underfueling. You can have secondary hypothyroidism as a result of overtraining or underfueling. So that by itself doesn't always mean anything. You know, if you do see a TSH that's abnormal, getting some follow-up labs done, a more complete thyroid panel for sure, making sure that, you know, you're covering all those bases with your fueling and that you're taking rest days or you're taking your easy days easy. Other things that I'll have athletes look at, especially if this is like a preseason lab, vitamin D levels are something I look at. There is a transport protein in our blood called ceruloplasmin. This is one that moves things like iron into our cells. So I will sometimes test that one if an athlete has had really stubborn low iron and see what that looks like. And then we'll kind of work from a nutrition standpoint to support that. So those are some labs generally I recommend looking at for performance. And then in terms of learning more about ranges that are appropriate for athletes, I don't encourage people to try to interpret their own blood work. I think it's important to understand what you're looking for and when it might be flagged as needing to seek some additional support. But generally, like I said, with iron, especially with ferritin, if you're seeing levels below 30, if you're seeing an iron saturation percentage below 25, if you're seeing a TSH level above 2 or below 1, those are some things where I would say it might be good to follow up with somebody who specializes in sports medicine specifically. Another key term to look for is functional medicine or functional nutrition. So there are functional ranges in blood work where our body is going to operate at its best from a physiological standpoint. And those are very different, like I said earlier, from those huge ranges that you'll see on your lab reports. The other thing with those ranges on your lab reports is they're actually based on the average of the general population going to that lab. So they might vary from lab to lab, which makes it harder to interpret. So those functional ranges are usually much tighter. They're kind of universal. So you're going to see the same interpretation no matter where you are or what lab you go to. And so that's something I would encourage you to do, is find a functional practitioner if you're really struggling to get your blood work where it should be. That is something that I do as a dietitian. So again, feel free to reach out if that's anything you're interested in working on. But those are some of my suggestions for blood work. This next question says, could you give some advice for fueling with PCOS? I'm a 32-year-old cis female running a high volume and have had very irregular periods for 5+ years. At the moment, 50-day cycles. Sometimes I go 6 to 8 months with no period. I would love to get back to the regular 28-day periods I had as a teenager, and it's so tricky to know whether the irregularity is due to my diagnosed PCOS or underfueling. My GP suggests it's a combination. I want to avoid going back on birth control and would love to have more regular periods and continue competitive running. I put a lot of effort into eating enough and the right kinds of things to support reproductive health, but there's a lot of info out there and it's so exhausting. Do you have any recommendations? Yeah, so first of all, I just want to say I'm sorry that you're going through that. I know it's incredibly frustrating just to not understand what's going on and feel like you're doing all the right things. Chances are you are doing a lot of the right things. And sometimes it's just a matter of a couple minor things that you might be missing that can make all of the difference. So with PCOS, that's polycystic ovarian syndrome, this is something that is actually often overdiagnosed in our healthcare system. A lot of doctors are quick to diagnose this for women with irregular cycles. So that is something where if you're not quite sure if you meet the criteria for PCOS or if that diagnosis seems like it's out of left field or doesn't really make sense, getting a second opinion is always a good idea, because With PCOS, a lot of doctors will immediately prescribe hormonal birth control to manage symptoms. But if you don't have PCOS, that's not really going to help you. And something that I've talked a little bit about, but haven't gone into too much detail on, hormonal birth control periods are not true periods. They're what are called withdrawal bleeds. Whereas with a natural cycle, your bleed happens because all of your hormone levels are dropping. So they're different causes of your period, and it's not a true period when you are on hormonal birth control. So it can't really be used as a measure of health. And for a lot of women who don't have PCOS, you know, this doesn't really help them with their symptoms. So I would probably agree with you that it could be a combination of maybe underfueling. There could be something at play with PCOS. You know, anytime I'm talking on here about medical conditions, I want to preface this by saying this is not medical advice. I am not a doctor. If you're concerned about your menstrual function, definitely encourage you to see a doctor, an OBGYN, to look at things and get some testing done. But typically in my practice, if I'm working with an athlete who has a condition like PCOS, or we suspect some type of hormonal related issue, I will do something called a Dutch test. So this is actually a dried urine test that takes a look at hormones over the course of a day. And this is super helpful for people with PCOS because it can tell us how your body is metabolizing hormones. So one of the main causes of symptoms with PCOS is that we see increased what are called androgen levels. So this is why women who have more severe PCOS might see, you know, facial hair growth, they might have a deeper voice. Some of those things happen because they see increased androgens in their blood. Another issue is that they have sort of estrogen dominant related symptoms. So this is usually because progesterone levels are really, really low in people with PCOS, but we also may just see overall elevated estrogen levels. And then within that, there are certain pathways that our body uses for estrogen detoxification. And in people with PCOS, sometimes those pathways are not functioning how they should be. They're more sluggish, so we see a buildup of estrogen in the body. So a couple things I recommend for anyone who's struggling with symptoms of PCOS is, first and foremost, supporting those detox pathways, making sure that they are functioning well to avoid a buildup of estrogen in the body, which is what often causes those symptoms. So some things that you can do to support those detoxification pathways would be staying hydrated, so making sure that you're drinking at least 100 ounces of fluid every day, that you're getting mineral-rich beverages in there as well, so electrolyte drinks, magnesium, some of those things also support those detox pathways. Making sure that you have regular bowel movements. This is a big one. If you're not having a bowel movement every single day, we do see more estrogen buildup because that is how our body gets rid of excess estrogen as well. So making sure you're getting adequate fiber, that is a big one for people with PCOS. There are also certain estrogen detoxification pathways that are preferable. Some of the ways that you can try to move estrogen down those preferable pathways would be things like limiting caffeine and alcohol, and then supporting the favorable pathways by adding in more cruciferous vegetables. Those are sulfur-containing foods that help with that process. So things like kale, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, and then overall reducing endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So taking a look at your beauty products, your household cleaning products, you know, Tupperware, trying to reduce exposure to plastics, getting a glass or a metal water bottle instead of a plastic one. Some of those things can kind of help mitigate the overuse of some of those estrogen pathways that are not preferable. Another thing that's important is supporting progesterone levels. So like I just said, we can have symptoms of estrogen dominance even if estrogen levels look normal, because progesterone levels tend to be so much lower. So some foods that support progesterone levels are foods that are going to be higher in B vitamins, vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, and magnesium. So for foods that are high in B vitamins, this would be any animal products, and whole grains are great. Fruits and vegetables in general typically have quite a bit of B vitamins, leafy greens. Vitamin C-rich foods would be any type of citrus fruit, so, you know, lemons, oranges, grapefruits, bell peppers, Brussels sprouts, broccoli. So that's nice that we have some overlap there with those cruciferous vegetables too. Vitamin E-rich foods would be any type of nuts and seeds, avocado, olive oil as well. Zinc-containing foods, a lot of seafoods and shellfish, and then magnesium-rich foods, again, nuts and seeds here, dairy products. So these are just some things to consider incorporating more of to support those progesterone levels. And then overall blood sugar balance is another one that's really helpful and important for people with PCOS. We tend to see more what's called insulin resistance, so more trouble moving sugar or glucose from your blood into your cells and using them for fuel. And so this would be balancing carbohydrate-rich foods with foods that have fiber, protein, and fat to reduce how fast your blood sugar increases, which makes it easier for your body to process that blood sugar at a better rate. When possible, focusing on those carbs that are higher in fiber, but this is not always the case, especially for somebody who's training. I would recommend low fiber foods right before your training, so within that 3 to 4 hour mark of, let's say, going on a run, and then focusing on the higher fiber carbohydrate options post training, so for dinner or post run. Other than that, you know, if you feel like you're really struggling with symptom management, you're just not getting much help or many answers from the medical professionals that you're working with, again, seeking out somebody who can do that type of testing, like the Dutch test. Like I said, that's something that I do in my practice. Determining how your body is actually producing and eliminating hormones, and then incorporating nutrition work to support your hormones based on those results. You're going to see results a lot faster. You're going to see symptom improvement a lot faster if you understand exactly what you specifically need to target. And then lastly, with PCOS, especially when somebody is dealing with that insulin resistance or maybe body composition changes, weight increases, I see people more likely to cut out carbs or try to follow a low-carb diet or do intermittent fasting. Those are not things that are helpful, especially for women with PCOS, like I said. Those do not help. A lot of times those can make things worse because high levels of stress can worsen PCOS symptoms. And so making sure your body has adequate energy, adequate access to energy, you're getting enough carbohydrates to support your training, in addition to just day-to-day needs, those are all things that can be really helpful. So bottom line, it's kind of hard to say exactly what you specifically should do to try to restore a more regular cycle, but those are some things I have done with athletes I've worked with in the past who are dealing with irregular cycles due to PCOS. Okay, this will be the last question because it's kind of a two-parter. So this one says, I have two questions, one based on an answer you gave to a previous question and one based on a race I just ran. The first question says, you were talking about how you don't know any runners who get enough carbs, and I think in your answer you separated fruits and vegetables out from carbs, but when I look up nutrition information, fruits and vegetables do have carbs. A banana lists 22.8 grams of carbs, and a sweet potato 20.1 grams of carbs. Am I missing something, or do you make a distinction between foods like rice and pasta versus fruits and vegetables? Super great question, and I'm glad that you're bringing this up because I know it can be kind of confusing. So yes, you are absolutely correct. Fruits and vegetables do contain carbohydrates. When I'm working with an athlete, I use a method called the performance plate. So this is something that was developed by the USOPC. They created this performance plate model to help athletes better meet their nutrition needs. And within those plate models, they categorize foods into basically four different categories. So we have carbohydrates, protein, fats, and then color, so fruits or vegetables. So fruits and vegetables, I would classify separately from carbohydrates. And what can be confusing is they do contain carbohydrates, but if I'm helping an athlete try to meet their fueling needs, those don't count as your carbohydrate. So let's say we had a dinner that was chicken with broccoli. Yes, we're getting carbohydrates from the broccoli, but we are not getting enough carbohydrates to support dietary needs as an athlete. Something I've sort of thrown out there before is that endurance-based athletes require 6 to 10 grams of carbohydrates per kilogram of body weight to have adequate carbohydrates to support training and competitions. So for a lot of runners, that's, you know, 300 plus grams of carbs per day. A cup of broccoli usually has about 15 grams of carbohydrates. So if we were just having that broccoli at dinner, we're getting 15 grams of carbohydrates, but that's not enough. We need to be trying to get closer to 75 grams of carbohydrates at a meal. So I would say for the purpose of getting enough carbohydrates, that is why I separate out color, so fruits and vegetables, from starchy carbohydrates. Sweet potato, for example, that can be one that can cross over categories a little bit. Banana, kind of same thing. But if we're thinking about trying to get multiple carbohydrate-rich foods at a meal, then that still wouldn't cover the amount of carbohydrates that we need. So even though a banana has more carbohydrates than a cup of broccoli, so a full banana would be closer to 30 grams of carbs, whereas that broccoli is about 15 grams, 30 grams of carbs is still about half of what we need at a meal. So I would still encourage that athlete to add a second source of starchy carbohydrates to get closer to that 75 grams of carbs at a meal. And these are just random numbers. I'm not saying that everyone needs 75 grams of carbs at a meal, but typically when I'm working with an endurance athlete, meals need anywhere from 60 to 100 grams of carbs in a meal. And just focusing on those carbohydrates from color, fruits and veggies, is not going to get you there. If it did, so let's say we were trying to get, you know, 60 grams of carbs from broccoli, that's 4 cups of broccoli. I don't know about you, but that would not feel so good on my stomach. That would not settle well. That would not end well for me. And that's generally the case for athletes who are trying to get too many of their carbohydrates from fruits and vegetables. They're getting too much fiber. So then we see more GI issues, especially if they're doing that right before a run. So again, that's another reason why I would say separating those two out prevents or helps keep runners from getting excess fiber, which can cause issues on your runs. The second part of the question says, when I run a half marathon, I wear a fuel belt. 2 of them contain sports drink while 2 contain water, and I take in 3 gels. My time is just over 1 hour 40 minutes. When I look around at other people who run roughly the same time, they don't seem to consume anything, maybe water or 2 at an aid station. I've always heard that I should consume something if the run is longer than 70 minutes, which mine is. Am I the outlier here? Do I need to take in what I'm taking in, or are the other runners missing a chance to fuel better and possibly run stronger? For the record, I'm in my mid-50s, if that matters. Another great question, and this is something, the comparison piece is something that gets in a lot of runners' heads, and you're not alone with that thought. People I work with will often say, like, nobody around me was fueling. Am I doing something wrong? And that's sort of our instinct as humans. That's kind of our nature as humans, is to immediately say, ooh, if someone else is not doing this, then I'm doing something wrong. What if it's the other way around? What if they're not doing something the way that they could be and you're doing something the way that you should be? So that's the first thing I encourage you to challenge yourself on, is if you are determining whether or not you should be fueling based on people around you, that's probably not the best approach. It's better to focus on what you specifically need to feel and perform your best. And science says, so not the people around you in a race, but science shows us that athletes who take in more carbohydrates and hydration during a run, they recover better and they have less performance limitations. One of the limiting factors for endurance athletes is carbohydrate availability during a run. So by default, if you were not getting enough carbohydrates, your endurance capacity is lower. And that is just the case for everybody. So I would argue it's probably more the second thing that you said in your question, which is that the other runners around you are missing a chance to fuel better and possibly run stronger. And it's not that you are getting too much. You know, if anything, most runners I work with could benefit from incorporating more fuel during those events. So it's all relative. It also depends on your experience with fueling, your pace, your effort. That does affect how many grams of carbohydrates you might need per hour. You know, the climate that you're running in, if it's hot, if you're at altitude, if it's humid, those are conditions in which you need even more carbohydrates. So generally speaking, anytime your run is over 70 minutes, I do encourage athletes to fuel regardless of what people around you are doing. And sometimes that can feel stressful or weird if you're pulling out a gel on a group run and no one else is taking a gel, but you're going to feel better and recover better because of it. And who knows, that might lead people around you to say, hey, wow, they're really improving. Maybe I should try that too, and create kind of a new approach to fueling for everyone around you. So that is what I would recommend. Thank you guys so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing these questions answered. If you have a question that you would like for me to answer on air, please feel free to submit that on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I'm really excited for next week's episode. You'll be hearing from my friend and former teammate, Emma Coburn. She will share her experience with fueling from a young runner all the way through being an Olympian and a world champion. So I hope you guys will tune in next week. Thanks again for being here, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.